Rob McCord, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
When you meet somebody on the porch and you've got 60 seconds to make your pitch, what do you say?
I say I'm passionate about running for governor because I think we need a governor who will succeed in defeating Tom Corbett and then succeed in investing in job creation and education, education, education.
Less than 60 seconds. You're in a field of with three other candidates who are accomplished people.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you different? What distinguishes you from this field?
Yeah, first of all, my three competitors are very impressive people. I want to tip my hat to that. I think it's the blend of personal experience, professional experience, and policy proposals, and sort of a bolder approach. I think people who really get to know me say you not only have a couple of bolder policy proposals that we think will make a big difference, bolder about public education, about having really high quality early childhood learning programs, for example, almost $250 million a year into that, but also bolder in your personality and in your ability to actually get things done, which you've done in a broad variety of business contexts, onto the experience, including helping to create thousands of jobs in Pennsylvania. I'm certainly not a career politician, but having 5 years in statewide government with a new generation of leaders has helped. I've been able to succeed in defending seniors, defend families who needed a repair of the college savings program. The personal experience, I was incredibly lucky by the time I was a teenager. My mom had remarried. I went to great public schools. I got financial aid to go to Harvard. But people kind of like the idea that I know what financial fear feels like and economic insecurity looks like. They have listened to some of the stories, those who are with me, about saying there are a lot of people out there who are working hard and playing by the rules, but who for good reason are suffering from financial insecurity. And that proportion of the American population, of the Pennsylvania population, has skyrocketed. And I think people realize that even though I've been a success in business, I really want to be there for people who are worried about their economic futures and the futures of their kids, and in particular there for people who depend on public education, because it was Pennsylvania public education that rescued me when I was a little boy, and my mom moved to Pennsylvania instead of New York, specifically because she had a younger son with undiagnosed dyslexia who needed help.
If you're governor, after 4 years, what do you hope will be your signature accomplishment?
Full and fair investing in public education across the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, an increase in the results per dollar invested in education, the broadest possible view of what education is, that it includes public-private partnerships and job training and community college, affordable college for middle-class families as well as others, extended school year, bigger investments in less affluent neighborhoods. Why? Because it yields a higher return. More affluent neighborhoods, the kids can go home and they can get education during the summer from their families, et cetera. By far, job one, year one, budget one is going to be about investing in education, education, education.
Do we need to continue the expansion of charters, or would you put the brakes on that?
I don't think it's brakes or expansion. You want to expand the better schools that include magnet schools. You certainly want to better fund schools like Central and Masterman. I mean, they've been here, these world-class schools, and we've been starving them for no good reason. You want to expand the better-run charter schools. I know that there's some issues with every school, but I think both Kip and Mastery are well run. But most importantly, you want to mend, not end, the charter movement in a way that stops the ripoffs. There are real ripoffs in the charter school movement. And they were ripoffs designed by people who kind of were embracing crony capitalism through politics. They knew what they were doing with all these special customized leases and things that have led to the FBI coming into town, more than a dozen times. There's real ripoffs. Some of it they knowing wrote, like compensating people for pensions not provided, for lunches not served. So the other thing, though, for the people who really follow this issue, the failure to continue the partial reimbursement for the kids who are leaving for charter schools was really criminal, because anybody who inspects a public school classroom understands that, you have 25 kids, you remove one, you don't remove 1/25th of the cost of heating the room. You don't remove 1/25th of the cost of the teacher or the school nurse. costs, so that you have to have the partial reimbursement. And the deplorable defunding and evisceration of public education, particularly in poorer school districts like Philadelphia, has been, you know, morally repugnant and economically stupid.
If you are elected, you'll probably be dealing with the Republican legislature. Give us an example from your experience that tells us you have what it takes to lead, to get people to work together.
Yeah, I'm excited about the opportunity. I think there's a sort of an unusual mandate, and people from the Brookings Institute were encouraging me to run because they said they've noticed in a lot of states with a Republican, either all Republican or lean Republican legislature, and an innovative Democratic governor are getting the most done. That the compromise that results, for example, in Philadelphia public education, the compromise is likely to be full investment in public education in exchange for more innovation and some increase in accountability in certain layers of public education, so that you'd have a really constructive compromise that you know, helps parents, helps kids, helps teachers. I mean, there's a way of doing this. And I have real relationships with the next generation of leaders in Harrisburg, which is a tough town. I haven't been there that long, only 5 years, but long enough both to see some of what's wrong and to have learned a lot about how to fix it and to develop some real relationships with people. You know, whether it's a Scarnati or a Pileggi in the Republican Senate, or my friend Vince Hughes, the Democratic Appropriations Committee chair, or the Democratic Appropriations chair in the House is a friend. I've got a lot of friends on both sides of the aisle. It polls well to address the legislature with pure derision. You also have to invest time, respect, and understanding. We will be able to get this done. I've gotten this done when it comes to repairing the college savings plan. I've gotten it done in getting more freedom in the budget for Treasury to increase productivity by 62%, even though we had to endure a 20% cut in budget. Time and again, I've been able to prove inside of state government that we can get this done on a bipartisan basis. And certainly my business career was a bipartisan business career.
I've heard you say in forums that people are going to have to choose among some very good people. You've said good things about your Democratic rivals. However, now that Tom Wolf has built up a big lead in the polls, you've run ads really attacking, really telling us he's a bad guy. Do you think Tom Wolf's a bad guy?
No. And I've tried to be very clear about this. I think Tom is an exceptionally good guy, and I know he's not a racist. I do not think he's well equipped to defeat Tom Corbett. And I think I am far better equipped to make the tough decisions and engage in the tough negotiations on behalf of progressive Democrats to get the best, fairest deals for Pennsylvanians. That is sometimes a policy nerd point, like I'm pushing for a 10% driller's tax. Tom is saying a 5% driller's tax. I've run an ad saying, why would we leave hundreds of millions of dollars on the table? This is a kind of a negotiation. And the fact that I have worked in a variety of industries, not just one family-owned firm, is a big deal. Second,
On the driller's tax, I mean, if he said we should have a 15% tax, couldn't he say you're leaving money on the
well,
table?
Well,
isn't it just a number?
It's far from just a number. So in Harrisburg, they're already having conversations about a 4 or 5% driller's tax. And that's with Tom Corbett as governor. I mean, let's be clear what's going on. We know 5% is too low. Second, really wild liberal states like Alaska, Montana, and North Dakota have a higher effective driller's tax than 10%. So you've gotten this silly sort of career politician approach where they got sold a bill of goods about West Virginia's tax rate. Well, why model yourself after West Virginia or Oklahoma? And Oklahoma, by the way, is making four times as much as we are. You know, it's clearly a wrong number. It's like pricing the sale of a house. You don't hire a real estate agent necessarily who just comes in and says, I'm going to try listing your house at the highest price. But you interview one who recognizes any special value, especially in location, location, location. Guess what? Tom Corbett never talks about the fact that we're closer to 61% of the market than anybody else is in terms of the demand for natural gas. So that's one contrast. And if you want, I can go into a couple of the others.
Well, I want to play an ad. This is one that you've run about Tom Wolf and a period in his past. Let's listen to this.
He spent millions on TV ads, but now serious questions Tom Wolf can't answer. Why would he chair the campaign of a man arrested for his role in a race riot, one that left a black woman dead? Why would Wolf stand by a man charged with first-degree murder? An admitted racist who handed out ammunition and shouted, "White power." For York, Pennsylvania, it was an ugly episode. For Tom Wolf, there's just no good answer.
Tough stuff. Now, everything that the announcer says there, it's true, but it's also true that the man that Tom Wolfe chaired the campaign for had been involved in these incidents 30 years before. He was acquitted at the trial.
Let's be clear.
Are you stirring a racial controversy?
Yeah. Let me be clear, first of all, how deeply personal this is for me. Had there been an answer to the question, what were you thinking when you said, I stand by him, I'll chair his general election campaign? This is 2 days after he was arrested, right? And 5 days before he dropped out of the campaign, Tom, after 2 days, the same number of days the NBA just took to say the right thing when it came to Donald Sterling, right? So some of this is the timing of what happened with the NBA and Donald Sterling and feeling like, you know, people really aren't focusing on the other question, which is how will the NBA react? In this case, Tom Wolfe was the NBA. He was the chair of a reelection campaign. And let me be very clear. I have no idea if this guy should have been convicted of first degree murder. What I know for sure is that he had admitted to being a police officer who yelled white power in the middle of a race riot. 30 years before. Hold on. And that his partner accused him of then giving munitions, I assume bullets, to a white racist mob. And that later that night, according to the indictments, that what that resulted in was the murder of an innocent African-American woman, roughly the age that my wife was when we were newlyweds. So this stuff is very, you know, it's very personal for me. And the real question is, after you found out that you had somebody who admitted to the abuse of police power because he admitted that he didn't investigate the crime, they said, well, it was an innocent white cop who was killed previously and then later, separate incident, African-American was killed. So we saw it as even. You got to understand. So that's an admission of an abuse of police power and an admission of a racist act and a probability that it was part of what resulted in a death. I don't need to hear anything more to say count me out of a re-election campaign. I mean, the NBA counted him out of the NBA and nobody was killed. And it was a private conversation. It wasn't a police officer yelling to a racist mob. So part of executive function is being tough. And frankly, Dave, sometimes it's making yourself uncomfortable. I like Tom. He is a nice guy. He's a really smart guy. I have reason to believe he's not quick to make smart executive functions when it comes to these kinds of important decisions. And one other point, there is an unacknowledged, relatively unaddressed set of issues surrounding race in Pennsylvania politics. I think they particularly impose themselves around public education. And to say we're going to fail to nominate somebody who is very good at recognizing the unaddressed issues of race and we're going to let somebody sort of buy it purely through TV commercials saying nothing to see here. Don't hold me accountable for my failure to step away from a racist after he admitted to racism in 2001. I think that's a mistake. And so I'm calling him out on it.
He, of course, notes that the African-American mayor of York, Pennsylvania, is supporting him, as are others who are holding a news conference to defend him. Are we going to end up with a racially contentious Democratic primary here?
You know, I don't know the answer. I know I take this very personally. I know the facts. I know that this was a police officer who admits that the police force failed to investigate the murder of an innocent African-American woman. I know that he admits to yelling white power in a race riot. And I know that Tom said, I chaired his primary campaign and I chair his general campaign election campaign, and that he signed a letter rebuking journalists for over-covering it. So I think that of all that, I'm certain. As to Kim and others who might want to stand by him.
That's the mayor.
Things that I worry about is it was your. It was that region of that state, right above the Mason-Dixon line, that created an environment that allowed the statute of limitations to be run on whatever, you know, lack of investigation went on for 30 or 40 years. So it's not surprising to me that people would circle the wagons and say nothing to see here. It's sometimes when we have real advances in these kinds of conversations, it's because we've made ourselves uncomfortable. That's what it will take to address the unacknowledged, underaddressed issues of race here.
One more thing. You've gotten a lot of support from unions in the campaign. Can you assure taxpayers that you'll be the kind of tough negotiator you need to be on their behalf?
Yeah. The short answer is yes. And, I, you know, it's a sort of an interesting point. I was just talking to the Philadelphia Business Journal about this. Even though I've got a disproportionately high number of endorsements from a lot of the labor unions, I don't seem to have many at all from the local trades here, the sheet metal workers, Johnny Dock and IBW, the carpenters. They're either sitting it out or siding with an opponent or whatever. And I think part of the reason for that is I've proven not once, not twice, but time and again, I can't be bossed and I can't be bought. Conversely, when you're talking about education support professionals and teachers, for example, one of the things they've seen about me is I have visited more schools, gotten to know more hometown heroes who are really sacrificing their own personal incomes and their own personal time, frequently public employees who are putting themselves at risk heroically, and they're being addressed by the current governor with derision. So I've always invested a lot of respect. And you know what else I've done? I've invested candor. I sat down with a lot of them at the end of 2009, and I said, your benefit plans need to be mended if they're not going to be ended. And I got them to help to embrace change, which led to a dramatic reduction in the benefit structure and a real reduction in long-term costs. So we reduced the unfunded liability of those two big state pension funds by more than $30 billion. So a lot of my closeness to the larger labor unions has to do with the fact that I was a good negotiator and I brought them to the table. And now I'm being a good negotiator and insisting that Tom Corbett do his part and invest the employer side contribution that's required. I think some of the trade unions in Philadelphia, I'm not their guy. You know, I'm not the candidate of any of the party bosses. We both know that. And I'm a very tough negotiator and I'm sort of an innovative business leader type from exurban Philadelphia. I mean, the 202 corridor, people from out there, they sort of know of McCord and the work I've done with an awful lot of companies.
Rob McCord, thanks so much.
Thank you.